Not that you're the type of person that's going to go to a fast food joint, but if you went to a fast food joint and you walked in and you said, hey, I'd like this meal, and they said, oh, would you like to supersize that? And some people say yes, some people say no. Well, if you went into your radio station today and said, oh, I'd like a panel, and we would say, oh, would you like us to supersize that? Well, today we did. And we have a just a brimming with panelists, and I couldn't be more delighted. So welcome to the program. It is Tuesday, the 22nd of May, 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and a thrill to have you with us. We always welcome you to join us via your emails, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So let me go around the room here. Libby Post is with us, communications political consultant. Libby Post is with us here, was with us yesterday, is with us today. We couldn't be more delighted. Good morning.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you very much. J.P. Miller of the Empire Report is here. Good morning, sir. How
are
you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Very nice, as always, to have you on the program. And another Tuesday regular, Teresa Bourgeois, communications consultant. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Good morning.
Very nice to have you here and to get your insight into what is going on in the world. Mike Spain is the associate editor of the Times Union. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
And Alan Chartok is here as well. Good morning, Alan.
Yes, I'm sort of there. Yes.
Yes, 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 yes. Well, so before we get into what is going on in the news, let us talk about what is going on in the world of WAMC, which is we have a lot of work to do to make $500,000 by the 4th of June, which is the first day of the fund drive. And to help us along with that, we have a challenge. Alan, tell us all about the challenge and why that's so important.
Well, the Spitzer Foundation has given us $25,000 on a condition, and that condition is that we raise that $500,000. And I'm extraordinarily grateful to them, but more so, I'm grateful to each and everyone who is thinking about doing this. You know what? We're living in a very dangerous time. And because it's such a dangerous time, I would say there are those people who are getting impatient. But remember who was there first for you when all of this was happening. It really was WAMC. When there were other people who didn't know whether to put their foot in the water and to create a real news cycle here and talk about really what was happening. And I'm talking about television channels and everybody else, all who are very cautious. There was WAMC out front for you. And you know it. And people keep coming up to me in the streets and saying that. So now, if we grow impatient and we say, Mueller isn't moving fast enough or this isn't happening, let's just try to remember why the WAMC is so important as opposed to virtually everyone else. You know, Joe, I guess I shouldn't talk about this, but another public radio station recently took a shot, and they said we would never do basically what they do. They're too opinionated. They're too this or that. And let me tell you, I'm very proud of what we've done, and I think it takes courage to do what we've done. And I need everybody right now to go to the lockbox and say, Alan, you're right. What would we be without this radio station? We listen to it. We depend on it. And you tell me that every time I see you. WAMC.org is the way to do it, or at 1-800-323-9262. Right now, we won't make it. Right now, it's going to take every single person doing something because we have over half the money to go and we have a little less than 2 weeks to do it in. Right, Joe?
That's right. We have $250,478.15. And by the way, who's responsible for that? But $250,478, and we need to get to $500,000 to get to halfway in the drive. We are halfway there to get to our halfway point. So
people always say to me, Joe, don't be scared. Don't be scared. We'll do it. We'll do it. And so far, we always have. But I need everybody, and we all need everybody's
now,
help.
Alan, yeah. But talk about the importance of what $25,000 means from the Bernard and Ann Spitzer Charitable Trust. They're putting up $25,000, and if we make this, we get the money. And my God, you can't pass up $25,000.
Just try to put $25,000 in your wallet, as I've said.
Oh, I've wanted to.
You know, there are days.
Dreamed about that.
There are days we take a trip and I try to put a couple of $100 in my wallet in 20s and it hardly fits. I'm just saying to everybody now, you know what this is about. I don't have to hector you or lecture you. You know what to do and you know why it's so important, even if it's just a little.
That's right. 1-800-323-9262 is the telephone number. We have wonderful operators standing by, better known as our staff. And we also, the easiest way to do it is online. And then, then our staff can continue to do the work that they do so wonderfully.
Now, I'm going to say something honestly to you, Joe.
Yes.
And I hope I always am honest, but I really am scared. I am. I'm scared. I'm worried. And I guess that's just the nature of it. I've always been scared and worried. But that's a lot of money to make in 2 weeks. But if everybody does something, we'll make it.
That's right. We will make it. And we'll make it if everybody realizes the importance of it. We'll make it if everyone realizes that everything that they do now is something that we don't do. And Alan made this point yesterday, and I think beautifully, which was, people can yell about us talking for a few minutes during the roundtable, trying to make some money for the lockbox. That's a lot different than doing a full-on fund drive where you are basically hijacking programs for a couple of days, which people love. People love the fund drive, but they also, especially during these times, want to have the programs that they rely on and why they listen to the station day in, day out.
And Joe, I remember you say a couple of days. I remember a couple of weeks.
Well, as do I, and through therapy, I've been able to forget most of that, but it's it's very difficult to
PTSD.
Yes, it's if we have to do that, we'll do it, right? I mean, that's the thing. If we don't do it this way, we can do it another way. But we're giving people an opportunity. We have a challenge on the table, and we can make $500,000 as we start the fund drive on June 4th. So all we ask you to do is to do your part, WAMC.org. As you always do, by the way, you're a wonderful audience, and we thank you for everything that you do. And this is just a general reminder, is all. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. And again, $25,000, which is on the table. So we cannot play around with that. All right. Well, we'll talk about more and hopefully give you an update throughout the morning. We'll talk more about that. Let's get into the news of the day and what's going on with our world. I don't know, but we'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
And that is, I was looking at stories yesterday, and I found one that from the Los Angeles Times that I thought perhaps was the maybe a good place to start for this morning. And that has to do with what is going on. There was a big meeting yesterday between the president and the Department of Justice, and it was looking into some of the allegations that the president has made. The president met with the Justice Department leaders, and this clash over the Russia investigation, according to this press report, is easing at least for now. Began like so many other controversies these days with the tweet, and it seemed to end Monday in typical fashion with a stalemate and confusion over President Trump's intentions. It was that first line that made me fall in love with this particular story. Fuming over reports that a confidential FBI informant met with three campaign aides, Trump tweeted Sunday that he would demand the Justice Department examine whether investigators improperly infiltrated or surveilled his team for political purposes, in quotes, during the early stages of the Russia inquiry in 2016. On Monday, he sat down with the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray, a meeting with the potential to be a dramatic showdown. Instead, the White House announced later that the Justice Department's Inspector General would review any irregularities with FBI tactics, a review that the Justice Department already had announced the day before in an apparent compromise. It was unclear whether Trump ever officially ordered the Inspector General's internal inquiry or something more comprehensive, as he had vowed to do in his Sunday tweet. Even as one head-on collision between the president and his Justice Department appeared to have eased, another loomed over Republican demands for confidential records about the Russia investigation. So a lot going on, and Alan, we'll start with you, and then we'll make our way around the room.
Oh, that's great. Well, let me just say that the idea of giving Congressman Nunes The information of the inside of this investigation is incredible to me, just incredible. We know that he keeps run up to the White House to give the president everything he knows. He is hardly a coordinate branch of government. He's a guy, and we have heard from the Democrats on his intelligence committee that he does it. He's a guy who is firmly in Trump's pocket. And it is a disgrace, of course. And the idea that Trump and his allies are saying, got to give Congress, the coordinate branch, the right to know exactly what my Justice Department is doing is beyond my comprehension.
But how much of this is just for show? I mean, we saw this with Congress ending their investigation into it and that sort of coming up with absolutely nothing and Senate continuing to do theirs and none of it really being taken all that seriously. I mean, isn't that what we're gearing up for here again?
They are desperate, Joe. They're desperate because they know that Mueller has the goods. They know that because they're people who have been indicted. They're people who have taken pleas. Others have come back to them and told them exactly what is going on. So they're scared to death. And any kind of information that they can get that helps them create a defense is what they're after. And as you can see, they're going to obfuscate as much as they possibly can.
Mike Spain.
Well, over the weekend, I guess on Sunday, the president began to tweet suggestions that the FBI was probably wrongfully using a informant, a spy inside the Trump campaign back in the spring and summer of 2016, and that was inappropriate. They're saying this. He'll say things like that. I've heard. It's out there. You know, and then he kind of repeats whatever the rumor is. Well, in fact, it's now been reported that there was an FBI source who did assist, an FBI informant who did assist the FBI in looking into potential conflicts and Russian involvement. He was a guy named Stephen Helper, and he was a professor at Cambridge in the UK most recently, but he had roots back to the Ronald Reagan, the George Bush administration, and even up through the younger Bush. And he did meet with three people in the Trump campaign on behalf of the FBI to ask them questions. And they were the people who've already been linked, like Carter Page and Stephanopoulos.
Papadopoulos.
Yes, George Stephanopoulos is not a McCartney.
Okay.
Anyway. What's amazing about this, they're saying that this is an outrage and it's awful and it's treasonous or whatever. And then, I mean, but the FBI was also looking into Hillary Clinton's campaign, which they reveled in. They said it was the greatest thing in the world. So
lock her up.
Exactly.
Teresa.
Yeah, I think that it's a classic case of swift boating, where you just attack, distort the facts. And unlike the investigation into the Clinton campaign, which was so very, very unusually public, this was not public at all. And in fact, it reportedly they took this measure as a way to keep it not public, to determine if in fact there was foreign infiltration into a U.S. campaign, but do it in a way that would not in any way interfere with the election. So I think that this is working for the Trump folks because it's a complex issue to begin with, and it's adding a layer of complexity. But it's a really attack on the process and on the Constitution. I just keep thinking of that moment at the Democratic Convention where Kazir Khan, the Gold Star Father, held up the Constitution mm-hmm. and said, "Have you not read this, sir? You can read a copy of mine." And I just think this demands an understanding or a rereading of the Constitution.
JP?
I agree with Teresa that it is working for Trump. This is a public relations war that he has launched. His approval ratings have gone from, in the low 30s now to over 40%. And it is because of this war that he is launched against our intelligence community. I think most would agree that it's interesting to find out who this FBI informant was, who they were speaking with in the campaign, and who ordered that. Was it Loretta Lynch? Did President Obama have an idea of what was happening? So this is an issue that Trump has found out about, and he's going to expose it and try and launch a public relations campaign on it.
Libby.
You know, there's not much more.
Have we left you speechless?
Well,
I can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot more to
say
about this.
I'll start with you next time.
Okay, except I just want to quote Michael Che from Saturday Night Live from Weekend Update this past weekend, and he said, "How often do you find a bunch of black men rooting for the feds?" And that's exactly it. Here we are, a bunch of lefties. I mean, I am, right? And many of us are. And we're rooting for the feds to do the right thing and to be able to do their job and expose what this is all about. And, you know, he's attacking law enforcement. And the people who support him are saying, rah, rah, rah. Let's attack law enforcement. Let's attack the intelligence community. But then when they need them, and they will end up needing them, they'll say, oh, no, no, we didn't really mean that. Let's go back to what we were doing it. But the other part of all this with this meeting is that once again we have Trump lashing out and then backing off, which is his modus operandi.
But it's effective.
Yes, it
right.
is.
It's working.
It makes him look diplomatic.
It's working for him, but not for the country. But I think we can't gloss over that. I don't mean gloss over. I think we have to shine a little, give a little attention to this outing of an informant, because that is no small matter.
Yeah, talk to Valerie Plame.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
We'll pause there, and when we come back, we'll have more. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. It's also a fine time to help out with the lockbox if you have a moment or two as you hear British people talking. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Teresa Bourgeois, J.P. Miller, and Libby Post making up the panel. And we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We do have some letters. We'll start off with those and then move on to other topics as we go through and continue with the story and add some other little bits to it. Peter writes and says, the purpose of an investigation is to find the truth, but that has no meaning to Trump. Only what serves his interest and what does not. If a DOJ investigation concludes that there was no infiltration of his campaign, that would of course mean that it was conducted by a bunch of Clinton supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Joel says, has WM... let me see. Okay. Keith says, I do not know what is more shocking, the fact that the president is demanding to see evidence from an investigation of himself and in which the DOJ complied with, or the fact that GOP Congress had obfuscated their constitutional duty as an oversight of the executive branch. Trump and the Congress both swore to uphold and protect the Constitution. This was their biggest lie. And this is something that I'm hoping that that has a question and a point from Bill, who says, good day, illustrious panel. Why are the Democrats so silent at this time when Trump and his cronies are actively looking to undermine the DOJ and the Mueller investigation? Is this a sign that the Democrats are in desperate need in their leadership? The Republicans would be screaming bloody murder every day if a Democratic president tried these tactics. That's a really good point, isn't it?
I think that the letter speaks for itself. I don't think anybody else has to say anything. It's right on point.
What? It's not that they're not speaking. It's that they're not breaking through. I mean, the Senator Schumer went to the Senate floor yesterday and gave an impassioned speech. They had a press conference. They were tweeting. They were... a whole range of them spoke out yesterday about how dangerous this was to our Constitution. But it certainly Fox News is not going to cover that. It just is not breaking through. It's not that they're not doing it. It's not breaking through.
And the question is, why not? Why? I mean, yes, the president sucks out all the airwaves, but what is it about mainstream media that they're not really covering what the Democrats are saying about this?
I don't think that's true at all. How would Teresa know about all the details of that? It's there.
She watches
Teresa
C-SPAN all day
example.
Long.
But your point, Mike. is that it's out there.
It's out there.
Well, you know, I think Theresa has a point, but I wouldn't blame it on the media as nearly as much as on the Democrats. You know, I don't think they're doing their jobs well. That's for sure. Look, you have to meet fire with fire, and in this case, it isn't being done well. That's simple.
So what do you do to break through? Do you act like Giuliani? I mean, that's the problem. To break through,
you have to
break
crazy.
Norms. You have to break norms of decency and protocol. And so do you do that? I mean, it's not that they aren't saying that... It's not that they're saying that this is just not right, it's not constitutional, it's dangerous. I mean, Senator Warner was all over the Sunday shows explaining why this is just not the right thing to do for our country or this situation.
You asked the question in the beginning, which is very important. And do you want the Democrats to act like Giuliani or whatever? The answer is yes. Sorry. The answer is that there is a new norm here that we are seeing about the way in which a good deal of the American people respond to speechifying and other things. And I think you have to ramp it up. Yes, I do.
Well, watching the Sunday shows this weekend, I was surprised also at the Democrats' lack of focus on this issue, and I think it might be because they see polling data that this may be an issue where Trump is winning on. Bernie Sanders was on Meet the Press trying to bring the focus back on inequality, bringing the focus back on there are so many Americans now that are trying to get by on a $9 and $10 minimum wage, and talking about pocketbook issues that Democrats and Americans really care about. And I think it may be that the Democrats see this issue as, boy, the more we talk about this, the more Trump's poll numbers go up. Let's talk about something where we can beat him on, which is the focus on how to make the economy better for everyday Americans and not just the rich and powerful.
Well, the Democrats yesterday outlined their agenda. I don't know that Sanders was there. You know, he's an independent, but the Democrats outlined their agenda and their policy agenda. Did that get covered? Not much. Certainly not on cable because it was all about this. But I don't think that the Democrats are not talking about this because they see it's not working for them in the polls. But the question is this going to be the new normal? Do you normalize behavior that's fundamentally unconstitutional and that will tear at the fabric of our Constitution and of our country?
And
do you normalize calling people animals?
And are they saying it? Are they saying what they should? You know, Theresa, I don't think it is a question of only speaking of the substantive issues, because obviously that isn't working. And when you look back in history and you see what happened at certain parts of the 1930s and the rest of it, where people did not appropriately respond at the right time, the consequences are disastrous. We have to, and I'm speaking for myself, not as a Democrat, but as a human being, we have to call foul right now and say that what he is doing is terrible, and we have to say it loud and often.
The question I have is, you saw yesterday Mnuchin went after Speaker Ryan, suggesting that he should step down indirectly, you know, pretty hard. Firm suggestion. So at what point is Speaker Ryan going to say anything about what is normal or constitutional?
He's not.
What point is McConnell? Because really now, just as with Nixon, it wasn't what the Democrats said that made a difference in the end. It's what when the Republicans started to speak up.
But it took a long time to get there. Right? I mean, in other words, the Republicans weren't great in the beginning. Baker wasn't great. Those other guys, I remember it as if it were yesterday. Tapes come out, information comes out. I'm assuming Mueller's going to come out. And that's when we'll see whether these people have any guts at all.
All right. I thought you were nobody going to add anything to that?
Well, no, I agree with you, Alan. I think the Republicans are waiting to have so much evidence in hand that they have no choice, and they'll welcome that because it'll let them come out and say, well, given the evidence, the indisputable evidence that, you know, Mr. Mueller has presented to us, we have to agree that it's time.
And that's
what they're waiting for.
And you know what, Mike? They have a problem. They all have a problem. If you take a look at the polling, it is the Republicans, which stay solid. The Republican voters are staying solid behind Trump. So now, if you look back in history, this is now 2050, and you're reading your history book and say, how did it go wrong? Where did it go wrong? They were more concerned about keeping their petty offices, and that's what they are, than doing the right thing. And the ones who do the right things are going to be the ones who are celebrated.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us talk about John Bolton for a moment. Who is to blame for the hiccup in North Korea talks? The South Koreans say it is John Bolton. This from the Washington Post. President Trump is blaming Kim Jong-un for changing the scope of their summit talks planned for next month and will doubtless air his frustrations when he meets with the South Korean president today. But in South Korea, many say the blame for the sudden problems in the diplomatic process lies squarely at the feet of someone else, John Bolton. According to a unification minister for North Korea, there are several landmines on the way to the summit between North Korea and the U.S. One of those landmines just exploded, and that is John Bolton. A lawmaker in South Korea ruling in their Democratic Party agreed, saying Bolton's preposterous Libya solution is a red light in North Korea's summit talks with the U.S. and South Korea. He wrote that in a Facebook post. That was Woo Sang-ho, a lawmaker in the administration of the South Korean president.
Now, the Libyan solution, just let's put that in context. That was when the Western countries put pressure on Muammar Gaddafi to denuclearize and to step back and to conform. And then Bolton is saying that North Korea needs to do that, but look what happened to Gaddafi and look what happened to Libya. So people are outraged at that. That has fueled this disagreement that's going on now, and it may sink these talks. And there's a lot of speculation that Kim Jong-un won't even show up when Trump goes to meet him just to snub him.
JP?
I see Bolton as more of a speed bump rather than a roadblock. I think Trump's past behavior has shown that he doesn't show respect for his own staff members. He doesn't listen to the advice or counsel of his other qualified staff members. That's why so many have left the administration and been fired. And so I think that when Trump meets with the president of North Korea, that he will do his own negotiating, and I'm sure he will tell the president of North Korea not to worry about John Bolton.
But he knew when he hired him what he was getting in John Bolton. So why wouldn't he adhere to his views? He knew what John Bolton has been absolutely consistent for years.
But couldn't you say that about anybody in the administration who's gone, whether it be a Steve Bannon or a fill in the blank. I mean, anybody.
Hey, we're talking about John Bolton.
Tillerson, anybody. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is John Bolton thinks he's in charge. And no one can come into that White House with that perspective, because the only one who's in charge, as far as the commander-in-chief is concerned, is the commander-in-chief. Everyone else be damned. And that's what's going to undo Bolton.
But bringing John Bolton in sends a signal.
Yeah,
right.
I get that.
What kind of person or what kind of philosophy you want around you? I mean, he's very clear, hardliner. He's been on the fringes for a long,
right,
long
time.
But
Trump will do whatever it is that he wants to do, regardless of what Bolton tells him to do.
I also think that the reason that Trump brought in Bolton is Trump is desperate for anybody that appears to be a qualified person. There are very few qualified people in the United States that want to go work in this White House, and he was desperate for someone. Bolton's a name brand he can bring in and kind of gives him some cover. If things go wrong, he can say, well, that was Bolton's fault.
Right.
Two other things. One, it's the art of the deal. Go read the book again. You know, he's about to face the president of North Korea, right?
Yes. I don't want to read the book again, but yes, you're right.
It's about the art of the deal. You know, things were going along swimmingly. It looked like there was going to be a deal. Bolton comes out, opens his big yap, I think, with the acquiescence of the president. And they put some roadblocks into the deal. And that's the way he conducted his business. Look at Ivanka. She always talked about it. And that's the way she said he operates. So that's one. And two, Bolton is more red meat for the base. And that's what it's all about.
But what both you and JP said assumes that Trump has a real understanding of the situation in both North and South Korea. And I just haven't seen any evidence that he truly has any depth of knowledge or understanding about the geopolitics in that region.
No one assumes he has deep knowledge of North and South Korea.
Right. I don't think he gives a damn.
And remember, Trump met with, as the newly elected president, met with President Obama the day after Election Day, that was what Obama said he loses sleep over. The Middle East is in a terrible situation, but it's nothing compared to the threat to world safety than North Korea is. And I agree. I think Trump looks at this as a transactional thing. You know, we can beat him up one day, praise him another day. I got my three hostages out. I'll get more. And it just doesn't work like that.
But he took two of those three hostages while Trump was president. I mean, it just... In any case, I just think if it's an art of the deal, if he's making a deal, that means you have a strategy, and the strategy means you have an understanding of what's going on, and I don't know where the strategy is.
Because your strategy is to win.
I see him as a little bit of a gambler, and that he is going to try to negotiate. If something happens that is productive, great, he'll take credit for it. And if something doesn't come productive from his meeting, he'll blame someone else. And so I don't think he sees downside in it.
But one of the things that I've heard over and over from some of the experts in the last few days, well, repeatedly, but more recently, is that North Korea is not a problem that you solve. It's a problem that you manage. And this, you know, notion that they're going to give up all of their nuclear weapons, and it's not realistic. It's not going to happen.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Teresa Bourgeois, J.P. Miller, and Libby Post. All right, let's go to some other topics this morning and see what else we can discuss. We were talking about John Bolton. Now let's talk about Mike Pompeo. In a hardline speech, Pompeo is criticizing Iran's behavior. The Secretary of State used his first major policy address to deliver a hardline speech in which he demanded that Iran change just about everything regarding its behavior on the world stage. He insisted that Iran end all nuclear enrichment programs and close its heavy water reactor, saying it did not have the right to such a program. He also appealed directly to the Iranian people, suggesting they should reject the clerical government in Tehran, the capital. Iran's right to, he said, quote, "What has the Iranian revolution given to the Iranian people?" Mr. Pompeo asked at one point and then offered an answer. "The hard grip of repression is all that millions of Iranians have ever known." What is the impact of such a hardline speech? Mike?
Well, it's very clear that they're trying to justify pulling out of the accord with Iran that the rest of the Western main Western leaders had embraced, and they're trying to back away from it and make impossible demands of Iran, demands that Iran will never agree to, when the accord that President Obama brokered along with other allies was going to keep Iran in some check. It was going to manage the crisis, as Teresa was referring to, like North Korea, and it was going to give an opportunity for growth, and it was going to play out over several years. It was never intended to be a unilateral disarmament of Iran, for them to pull out of Syria and all these other conditions that were not even on the table when it was negotiated. He's just trying to make it look like they did the right thing and Iran, and, you know, making Iran the enemy, which, you know, it certainly is an adversary of the United States. You can engage with them or you can pull away. It's just so ridiculous when you think about how we're engaging with North Korea, but we're stopping engagement with Iran and provoking them with this.
Libby?
It makes no sense. You know, Pompeo was beating his chest is basically the deal. And what's disheartening is that as we pull out, there are, while the Europeans didn't want us to, some of those countries are capitulating, because some of the companies in those countries are capitulating because they have no choice because of their business with the United States. And, you know, for Pompeo to get up there, and he really did just beat his chest and this is the way it's going to be, I mean, it speaks to this authoritarian way of doing things in this administration, and that's not diplomacy.
I thought it was remarkable that during Obama's second term, his key foreign policy achievement, the Iran deal, was voted against by Chuck Schumer, that the number two Democrat in the Senate voted against it. Why would Chuck Schumer vote against the key foreign policy achievement of the sitting Democratic president of the United States?
Israel. Why indeed? Israel. Why indeed?
Israel.
Right. And so I think Trump is prioritizing the relationship with Israel over this deal with Iran that Chuck Schumer voted against. And the other partners in the region that aren't backing us up, those are also the same partners in the region that did not show up at the opening of the United States Embassy in Jerusalem. And it's simply a difference of policy opinion based on what Trump's worldview is and Trump's view of the Middle East versus Obama's view of the world in the Middle East.
Well, look how dangerous it is. Just look at what Pompeo is really saying, right? He's saying, do it our way or we'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what he's saying. Look, we will give you sanctions you won't even believe are possible. You will be out of business. You'll be at this. And then, there's always the military option, which Trump keeps talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that they're asking Iran to do, they're asking them to end all aspects of its nuclear program. Sounds reasonable. Stop uranium enrichment.
But that's an impossible thing to expect.
Halt support for terrorist groups. Halt support for terrorist groups.
Would they ask the Israelis to do that?
That wasn't the deal.
But that wasn't the deal. That's exactly right. This was another deal. They're now withdrawing a deal that was already made that had to do with nuclear arms development in Iran. And they're changing the terms, which we would all love. I mean, everyone would love for Iran to pull out of Syria to completely, end ballistic missile use and et cetera, et cetera. But that wasn't the deal that was back then. And now they're faking it. I mean, I think they're swapping it. I think it's a bait and switch. They're suggesting that this is why this deal is no good. You're not going to get to the deal that you're talking about, the one that Israel would rather have and opponents of Iran would rather have, unless you're able to engage with them. And what we've done is we've ended engagement with Iran. We've snubbed in their face and we've just protracted the whole complicated thing already.
And it enabled weakened the sort of the middle ground players, the moderate players, and enabled the hardliners. But the other thing is I listened to Pompeo's remarks. You can hear it on C-SPAN. And was listening to it in the context of today's meeting with the South Korean leader and in advance of the meeting with North Korea. And I just was trying to understand what Pompeo's strategy was there. So, the North Koreans had to be listening to this, right?
Yeah,
they listened to everything.
His strategy to say to the North Koreans, if you don't deal with us, this is what's going to happen to you too? I mean, from my perspective, I have to tell you, from my perspective, nixing this Iran deal was just one more notch in the belt of getting rid of anything that Obama did. That's really the agenda here, is to undermine and delete every policy initiative that Obama did. And, when we really look hard at the language and we really look hard at some of this policy, you're going to see Stephen Miller behind all of this, because he's really the one who's got his hand up Trump's back and making him talk.
But also think about this in the context.
Didn't know where that was going.
Think about this too in the context of the significant increase in arms sales to the Saudis and to others in the region, just the incoherence of this approach. And JP, would Pompeo ever ask this of our allies? Would he ever ask this of the Israelis?
Well, I think that to ask Iran to stop uranium enrichment, stop military aspects of its nuclear program, you see what's happened with North Korea.
So do you think the U.S. should ask that of the Israelis also? The Saudis?
I don't think that's the policy of the United States.
Of India?
I'm not saying that it's my opinion. I'm saying this is why Trump is doing this. It's a simple I would say that elections have consequences, right? And yes, Trump is trying to undo everything he can that President Obama achieved during his 8 years. I think when President Obama was brought in, he tried to undo everything that he could of George W. Bush's previous 8 years. That was the mandate of the election. So yes, they will have policy differences on foreign policy. This is something that Chuck Schumer voted against. Why this is something that is seen as it's some right wing conspiracy. I think it's something. Why would Chuck Schumer vote against it? Why?
Because of Israel. Israeli question.
Right. It's the Israeli question for Schumer.
Remember, Netanyahu came and spoke before the Congress when Obama was president at the invitation of the Republicans. And you know, they have a lot of political weight.
Right. And so,
same reason that Schumer wasn't really aligned with most of the Democrats on right now moving the embassy. U.S. embassy.
Right. So if you're running a foreign policy, I think that you do what's in the interests of your allies, and Israel's our key ally. And Iran isn't our ally. Why are we going to do what's in the best interest of Iran?
Let's pause there. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters on our spirited conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Good morning and very nice to have you. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to other topics in a second, but I do want to read some of your letters before we get to those and move on to other topics as well. Glenn says, maybe as part of the negotiations, Iran should demand that the U.S. not park its spy satellites over their country permanently. Do you think America would agree to that?
No.
Reed says, any way you look at it, the Democratic leadership is not doing an adequate job of being visible to the population. We cannot afford to be passive and stay on the sideline while conservatives apologize for this disaster of a president day in and day out. Grow a spine, call out the BS, and promote the platform already. Jack says, as Trump the Bull trods the China shop of our democratic institutions, I like that.
Nice
writing. Nice going, Jack. As Trump, the bull, trods through the China shop of our democratic institutions, I am growing increasingly concerned that he will not be brought down easily. My guess is that had the DOJ and FBI not yielded a bit, Rosenstein, Ray, maybe even Mueller would have been fired yesterday. All indications are that Trump won't go without handcuffs.
No, I agree with that. I think that's what I've been saying all along. It's what I said yesterday, if you remember, Joe. The idea that in fact this is they had to avoid that at all costs. So they say, okay, we'll investigate it. So what?
But no, at what point? Thing. At what point, Alan, do they need to resign in protest?
Well, when they resign in protest, they lose, don't you think?
Without question, Mike, you are so right.
Laura says JP is right. Trump may be a gambler, but if the money reports are right, he has been staked by the Russians. He never plays with his own money, so he's never fully invested in anything other than his own ego. And Laura also, this has nothing to do with what she's writing, but she has a quote from the great philosopher Winnie the Pooh here, and it says, you are braver than you believe, stronger than you seem, and smarter than you think.
You can never lose with...
No, AML and then Winnie the Pooh. No, you can't. And then Barbara says, the Democrats' response to the corrupt administration's unconstitutional aggression, doubling down on the wimpy motto, a better deal, and putting out a dense, unreadable policy paper that absolutely no one will ever read. They just don't seem to know they need to go on the offensive. And a better motto, if they must have one, we, the people, all of us, not just Trump's base.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's right. And that's where Teresa and I think, disagree. She has great faith in the American people that they will read that boring policy paper, but they won't.
No,
they won't.
Do you agree with that?
No, I don't think they'll read the boring policy paper.
That's why we have you.
I
do think they need some, you know.
Well, you read it.
They won't read the boring policy paper, but let's not underestimate what is going on in the grassroots,
right?
And the activism that is happening all over the country. And they don't, I mean, I don't read the boring policy papers, but I know what needs to be done, and there are many, many others who do as well.
But what I don't do you see mean? Someone emerging but, who is grabbing these, you know, these policy papers and interpreting them in a way that revs up people.
Right. Well, 2018 is all about Congress, so it's going to be the congressional candidate who can rev up their local. Their locality. But after 2018 is over, you will see somebody hopefully emerge
and I do
from,
think
on the presidential level.
You have some really exciting House races around the country with some folks who I think, and I'm sure Senate races too, but I think that there's some really interesting people out there who, if get elected, can help change the dynamic.
So let's use this as a test. If you're a Democratic candidate running in Oklahoma or running in even in New York.
Indiana.
Who from the Democratic Party do you call in to help you raise money?
To raise money?
Yeah. Who are you looking at that is a speaker or someone who is an outstanding spokesperson for the Democratic Party? Who do you call in to make a lot of money?
That's a great question.
Crickets.
I think you can bring in Adam Schiff. I think you can bring in.
The people that they are bringing in, they're bringing in Cory Booker, they're bringing in Elizabeth Warren.
Cory Booker, who's came to mind. Elizabeth Warren's not, not for everywhere.
I mean, there was an article in the Times that yesterday that most candidates are staying far away from Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Barack Obama would be great if he's willing to do it.
If he's willing to do it, but he doesn't seem to be ready to do it yet.
No, he just inked a big deal with Netflix.
Yes. So my point is that who are the future leaders of the party that normally would be going out and raising a lot of cash?
In fact, Hillary Clinton is raising. Sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you go. Go ahead.
I was going to say Hillary Clinton is raising a lot of money and helping a lot of groups that are grassroots groups, helping.
But in safe liberal areas, in safe liberal areas.
No, not necessarily.
She's got a group. She has a new organization helping women run.
Right, helping women run. Helping
forward
a lot
together.
Of people run.
Yeah, forward together. Right,
and they really. Working with a lot of these grassroots efforts.
She's not helping women run for the governor of New York, though.
No,
decidedly helping a guy against a woman.
Right.
Yeah.
But she is.
Good point, Mike.
She is helping candidates around the country. So I think that's the case. But I think I thought you were going to ask something else, which is what issue. And I think, and Carvel backed this up, and I think he does know polling around the country in key races. But health care is what's really resonating for people, that while we're all talking about, you know, Mueller and this and that, that's not resonating for people. What's resonating for people is health care. And I think one thing that Democrats do need to do more of is shine a light on what the Republicans are doing to dismantle the health care system in this country.
Without an alternative health care system in place.
Right, But I think health care remains a key issue in polling. And Carvel was on talking about this regionally, in, you know, key races and how it's making a difference.
So let me ask you a question, Teresa. How you're the news director at CNN or MSNBC, you have to decide what stories come up front, healthcare or Trump's latest foibles?
I would be, this is why they would never let me be the news director, but I would be.
They don't want their ratings to go down.
I would be doing a lot more on the issues. I would be doing a lot more on healthcare, what's happening on healthcare. I think, like, even this.
But those two don't, I'm sorry to interrupt, but those two don't go together, right? I mean, what we're saying is that the polling suggests that the people are concerned most about their healthcare, and yet we in the media and the candidates are not talking about that subject.
I think candidates who are running for Congress are talking about that. Yeah. I mean, listen, Delgado, I heard him yesterday. But, he was healthcare.
They're talking about the farm bill.
And they're talking about the farm bill. They're talking about clean air and clean water.
I think as we find the people who are dying or have died, we find those stories because of the cuts in healthcare. It will get back into the news cycle because that's what we need. Unfortunately, that's the kind of stories that will get covered. Is the real impact to people,
and it isn't either or. Let me just point that out.
But there is a balance that you can strike, and I think, you know, I've been watching cable a lot more lately, just because I wanted to see. And I think that they're off balance. I think that you could strike a better balance. I mean, look at some of the stuff that Glenn Thrush, you know, was New York Times, off for a while. He's back. He's doing some great work on poverty, great writing on poverty issues and some of the policies that are going on. Look at in Michigan. They just reversed this. There's a ruling there on Medicaid that it was going to be means tested, but just for people who were in minority districts and not, you know, the rural white population, and they got that reversed. So there are things that are happening out there besides the Mueller investigation.
There also continues to be a huge dissatisfaction with Congress. And Trump, despite his numbers going up a little bit, he is a hugely unpopular president. Mm-hmm. It's his first midterm election. If you look at history, this should be a very good year for Democrats to hopefully take control of Congress.
As long as impeachment isn't part of the overall messaging.
And that's why I think Republicans are trying to make impeachment part of the messaging,
exactly,
because they
why.
Think it helps them.
That's right.
But where's the Republican infrastructure bill, right? Where's the Republican infrastructure bill?
Where's the Republican health care alternative?
Where's
the increase in
wages? But the Democrats, they're not doing a great job on offering alternatives either. They seem to be just sitting back.
The problem is it's buried in this long, you know, tome that they released yesterday. Yeah. It's there. They have policies. They're just not breaking through and messaging in a way that people are hearing.
Well, when you say breaking through, you mean getting the headlines on the cable channels.
Right.
That's what you have to
how
do
you compete with Stormy Daniels and
Iran and North Korea? No, I agree. It's a challenge. And unfortunately, CNN and the other cable channels are out to make money, so they're going to go where the ratings are. And there is a sort of an addiction to the headlines and the little crawlers about Trump and his tweets and all that kind of stuff, and it gets more eyeballs than something that's a little softer.
Except that I have to tell you, I'm taking the con on this one. I think Trump is a dangerous, at least pre-fascist in this country. I think what he's doing to this country is, you talk about the norms and you talk about how he is undermining the Constitution. That comes first in most people's minds. And every time he does it, it goes up front and should go up front.
I agree with you. But why can't you have it both ways? Why can't you have, if in that coverage, and I agree entirely with you, Mike, but on those panels, have Democrats who are willing to go out and just lose their stuff over what is happening and just blow up instead of this just sort of,
I mean, they could have filibustered yesterday in the Senate or something.
I mean, that's what I don't get.
So you should fight fire with fire and have crazy rhetoric going on the other side.
I don't think it has to be crazy rhetoric. It isn't crazy rhetoric. It's the truth and facts. That's different.
I mean, nobody's making the really big headlines about what they're doing to Planned Parenthood again. They're pulling funding from family
planning
clinics.
Well, that doesn't seem to be getting traction, though. I mean, in all fairness, that doesn't seem to be getting traction. It seems like that was a one-day story and it hasn't really happened.
Right, but it's not getting traction because people don't see it as being important.
Not the story.
No,
I think it's just because
the shooting happened horrific shooting happened after.
Right.
If the Republicans were actually cutting funding on stuff, I think it would be a lot better for the Democrats. The Republicans have passed the largest budget in the history of the United States, larger than anything that Obama ever passed. So if there were cuts to funding, like when George W. Bush in his second term wanted to take on Social Security, that really stimulated the base and motivated voters. On spending cuts, it's hard to put that on this Congress. Although what I would focus on, like Teresa said, is health care and income inequality. Those are pocketbook issues that will motivate voters.
Look at this Supreme Court decision yesterday. Mm-hmm. Right? On workplace arbitration, what's that going to mean to people?
Well, that's right. And it's too up here. It's too
very
complicated
few headlines on that.
For
I was
people
surprised.
To really, but also for people to understand.
I had to search to find a really good comprehensive article to include that in our docket, which unless I get to it now, we're not going to get to it. So let me move in that direction. But I was really surprised that it was as hard as it was to find something because it's such a momentous.
It is a huge
huge decision. happens. So what happens as soon as I'm able and to it, bring up my headlines?
It sets the stage
allows,
for the Janus decision.
It allows companies to prohibit its employees, when they get hired, they sign something saying so, to ever form a union or do any kind of collective bargaining.
5-4 could affect some 25 million employment contracts. Writing for the majority, Neil Gorsuch said the court's conclusion was dictated by a federal law favoring arbitration and the court's precedents. If workers were allowed to band together to press their claims, he wrote, the virtues Congress originally saw in arbitration, its speed and simplicity and inexpensiveness, would be shorn away, and arbitration would wind up looking like the litigation it was meant to displace.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, so outraged, she took the unusual step of actually reading her dissent, mm-hmm. which is very unusual.
And using the term egregiously wrong.
Yeah, and she called on Congress to correct this, not expecting this Congress
not to
correct
that's
it.
That's going
to
happen. But, you know.
But just think about the JP, you'd probably be better on me than me on this on the details, but you can't join together to have a collective suit. And you're probably signing these arbitration
no
rules.
More class action
No
suits.
More class action
That's
suits.
What this is saying.
By
this
employees against their own company.
Right. This isn't saying they can't organize.
But
that's the next suit.
Right. But this suit is you cannot join together.
That's the sequel.
That's the Janus decision.
Right. But you can't join together in a class action lawsuit.
Right. But we'll find a way around it. I guarantee you labor will find a way around this.
And I think
I don't know about that, Libby.
With lots of individual lawsuits.
I don't know about that. The unions have blown it again and again. They haven't organized correctly. They haven't, again, they haven't gotten out front on this stuff. This is an awful decision. And it's just one more nail in the coffin.
Who wants to, did you want the last word, JP?
I read about it. I'm not an expert on labor law. We have it as our top headlines because, like you, Joe, it was very hard for me to find that news article. I was surprised by that.
All right, we're going to end there and just give us 30 seconds or so to remind you that we have a major challenge on the table from the Bernard and Ann Spitzer Charitable Trust, $25,000 to get to the halfway point in the drive. We're well over 250 there so far, but we still have a long way to go before June 4th, Alan.
Do we ever? And, we had a letter from a guy very quickly who said, will you guys stop saying it? You know you're going to meet it. Believe me, I never know we're going to meet it. I'm scared to death. It's $250,000 in less than 2 weeks. I need everybody to put somebody in. We need everybody to put something in.
You know, I saw that letter, too, and I thought to myself, you know, if we didn't do our job and just – it's not just going to happen. You have to remind people and tell people and do – and it has to. You have to have constant reminders to have people understand the importance of it. And if we didn't do that, it wouldn't happen.
Oh boy! I know this guy. Forget about it. Let's.
All right. Go on.
Forget about it.
All right.
I love that, Alan.
WAMC.org 1-800-323-9262. Thanks to this wonderful panel, the big large group in here today. Thank you very much to you all. We'll be back right after this.